Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Ovarian Cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have many participants on the call today. We have over 962 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada and the United Kingdom, so you really come from all over the world. And it's a credit that you're spending the next hour with us. This activity is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing, and as well as all the different collaborating organizations as resources for each of you. And we also have an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. Your feedback really helps us to choose the topics and the programs that we offer throughout the year. So please take a moment and tell us what you'd like us to offer. Indeed, today's program was a topic that many of you have asked us to offer, and so we're offering it, and indeed would like to do it again. So again, your feedback, really, we take it quite seriously, and you are the best people to tell us what we should be doing. So we very much rely on your feedback. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. And Dr. Runowitz is Executive Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, Professor, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Florida International University, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine. Now, Dr. Runowitz is going to address really an overview of ovarian cancer, really including both its current standard of care and new treatment approaches, clinical trials, and also controlling side effects and pain and communication with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Runowitz, who's going to really give you all that's up to date on ovarian cancer treatments. Dr. Runowitz?
Thank you. It's my pleasure to once again join this conference. So I'd like to start with giving a little background in ovarian cancer, then move to what's the current standard of care. Some new treatment approaches. Many of you may know that we just had the big cancer meetings in Chicago, and there were some new treatments that were discussed and many on the horizon that will be of interest to people on the conference call. So let's start with an overview of ovarian cancer. There are approximately 22,000 new cases of ovarian cancer in the United States. But what's important, I think, about ovarian cancer is not where it stands in respect to other cancers, but that ovarian cancer has become a chronic disease for many women with ovarian cancer. So they may present with the disease, they may get their initial treatment, and then they will live 5 to 10 years with the disease. So it's really become a chronic disease, which is a real challenge with respect to treatments and managing side effects. Unfortunately, ovarian cancer doesn't have an obvious symptom like postmenopausal bleeding or rectal bleeding or a mass that one can easily feel because the ovaries live in the pelvis and they're not easily accessible to early detection strategies. Interestingly, some of our new data suggests actually that ovarian cancer may be really fallopian tube cancer and not ovarian cancer at all. And the importance of that is in early detection. The fallopian tubes are more in contact with potential vaginal screening methods than the ovaries are. So that particular observation may have significance with respect to prevention and with respect to screening in the future. So since there aren't any obvious signs or symptoms, are there any at all? And the women who have gotten ovarian cancer are very clear that there were symptoms that were missed. And these symptoms are very vague: bloating, weight gain, intestinal discomfort, indigestion, urinary urgency, sometimes pelvic pain. But they're very nonspecific and often attributed to the bowel or the irritable bowel or to the colon. And so we unfortunately don't have a specific sign or symptom. The CA125 is an antigen that the ovarian cancer was found to secrete, was discovered about 1980 or so. And we use that for following patients with ovarian cancer to monitor their response to therapy. In screening, it's been a little bit mixed data on whether it's a useful test for screening, but studies are ongoing to evaluate that. So if you don't have signs or symptoms, are there risk factors that would make you at risk and would sort of highlight that you should get screened? And the biggest risk factor is getting old, like for all cancers, is getting older and being female. And I don't say that facetiously. It's really true. As you get older, you increase your risk of getting any cancer. Ovarian cancer is included in that. And then obviously being female, because males don't get ovarian cancers simply because they don't have ovaries. As far as family history goes, it's very important to know your family history. We all have heard about Angelina Jolie, whose mother had ovarian cancer, whose aunt had breast cancer. And for those of us that work in this field, that mention of a mother and an aunt with breast and ovarian cancer sort of is like a red light flashing that says that there's a risk for a genetic mutation or a BRCA, BRCA1, or BRCA2 mutation. These, however, the familial ovarian cancers only account for up to 10% of all ovarian cancer. So most women do not have a family history of ovarian cancer. However, if you do, then you might get counseled and then perhaps tested for one of the mutations in BRCA1 or BRCA2, and there are some other, Li-Fraumeni, the Lynch syndrome. There are several other genetic syndromes that have an increased risk of ovarian cancer and other cancers, for example, breast cancer. So like Angelina Jolie, it's possible to do prevention. And as everyone knows, Angelina Jolie had a prophylactic mastectomy, and she has told the press that she will deal with her ovaries at a later time. And that's because taking out your ovaries will put you into premature menopause. And, you know, here we have the most beautiful woman in the world who's young and is facing losing both breasts, reconstruction, and then possibly having to deal with premature menopause. So there are a lot of issues that she has to deal with. Now, remember a few minutes ago I told you that maybe ovarian cancer is actually fallopian tube cancer. So we are still studying this and still evaluating that this may be the source of some, if not all, ovarian cancer. Therefore, you could actually just take out the fallopian tubes and not the ovaries. However, that's a very provocative statement, and there is no data to support the safety in that. I only bring it up because it's of the importance of research and clinical trials in establishing a concept like that. So I think if you follow the literature, we will, you know, continue to evolve in our thinking of where does ovarian cancer really originate from, and is it really ovarian cancer? And then are there things that we can do short of taking out the ovaries? Do I think that this will be ready in prime time for somebody like Angelina Jolie? No, I think it will take us longer. So there are other things that one can do to reduce the risk. Pregnancy, for example, reduces the risk. So the more pregnancies you have, the lower your risk of ovarian cancer. If you've been on the birth control pill, the longer you've been on the birth control pill, the better the protection. If you've had a hysterectomy, even though you leave the ovaries behind, the risk of ovarian cancer is reduced, and I'm not sure we understand quite why that is so. And women who have their tubes tied, getting back to the fallopian tube again, women who have had their tubes tied have a lower risk of ovarian cancer. So we don't have a specific risk factor like we do in other cancers. So, for example, in endometrial cancer, if you're obese, hypertensive, diabetic, you're at risk for endometrial cancer, you're at risk for colon cancer, and you're at risk for postmenopausal breast cancer. We don't have any of those clearly delineated risk factors. We have more generic, not so specific risk factors. So once one is diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and the issue is, do the symptoms of ovarian cancer permit us to diagnose it earlier? And there again, the data is very mixed. And there is some data that suggests the earlier you go, the earlier the stage, but I'm not sure that that's a general consensus of the literature. So once you are diagnosed, though, the treatment involves surgery followed usually by chemotherapy, although the reverse order where you may get chemotherapy first and surgery second may occur. It's very important that when you get your surgery, you get it done by a qualified, competent, trained physician. And in the United States and Europe and Asia and other countries, that person would be a gynecologic oncologist. So although your OBGYN may make the diagnosis, your OBGYN is not trained in these radical surgical techniques to remove every morsel of tumor. And the data is very clear that if you have what we call cytoreductive or removal of as much tumor as possible, your prognosis and overall survival is better. And so you want to get the best surgeon, and that surgeon is a gynecologic oncologist. The Society of Gynecologic Oncology has actually listed the physicians who are available throughout the world, and so one has easy access through the internet for finding the right surgeon. So once you have your surgery, you recover from your surgery. This is usually followed by chemotherapy. And chemotherapy is the standard across the world, really, is carboplatin and paclitaxel. The alternatives to getting carbo and Taxol IV are to get the treatments intraperitoneal. There have been three randomized clinical trials that have clearly shown that intraperitoneal chemotherapy in women who have been optimally cytoreduced, that is, most of the tumor has been removed, do better than those who receive standard carbo and Taxol. So again, this is an option that one wants, that one should discuss with the gynecologic oncologist, or if the gynecologic oncologist isn't going to give the chemotherapy, the medical oncologist. And often the medical oncologist, the surgical oncologist, the GYN oncologist will all work as a team, and they will recommend the best treatment. Intraperitoneal chemotherapy, that is a belly wash or a belly bath or chemotherapy in the belly, is a somewhat more difficult to deliver. The data suggests that with the regimens that have been published, only about 60% of patients actually complete all six therapies. Even though the data suggests that 40% do not complete therapy, the results are still better for the intraperitoneal. So certainly that is worth discussing with one's doctors after one finds out that you've had optimal surgery. If you don't have optimal surgery, and in the United States, probably 60 to 70% of patients can have optimal surgery where all the tumor larger than a half to 1 centimeter is removed. About 30% of patients don't have complete removal of the tumor. In those patients, the intraperitoneal chemotherapy would not be an option for first-line therapy. So when one finishes the chemotherapy is usually 6 to 8 cycles. In the United States, it's more often 6 cycles of therapy. Then the question is, what do you do next? And there's a treatment that's called consolidation therapy, where after you go into a complete remission on first-line therapy, you go and get other treatments to consolidate that complete response. And so that therapy is called consolidation therapy. To date, there really have not been any successful consolidation therapies, except perhaps in some of the newer trials using bevacizumab. And this year at ASCO, there was one trial that used what we call PAZO, which is pazopanib, another kinase inhibitor that's a multi-kinase inhibitor of not only the anti-angiogenesis but platelet-derived growth factor and c-KIT. So when given 6 months following the completion of the chemotherapy, it seems as though there may be an improvement in progression-free survival and perhaps overall survival, although the bevacizumab data has not shown that to date. So one is monitored, or one goes under consolidation therapy, and one is monitored usually with something like a CA125. And the if the CA125 stays below, at your normal, whatever your normal is, usually less than 35, and for some patients way less than 35, you just continue to be monitored at regular intervals, and you are also screened for other related cancers, such as breast cancer or colon cancer. If, however, the CA125 begins to rise, you then become a candidate for a clinical trial or some new treatment approaches. The standard treatment after one CA125 elevates and one is diagnosed with recurrence is dependent on the timing from the time that the disease, the treatment of the disease was completed to the time that a recurrence is diagnosed. If that disease is less than 6 months, it's called platinum resistant, and if it's greater than 6 months, it's called platinum sensitive. And in my opinion, at this time, if you do develop a recurrence, the best thing to do is to find out about clinical trials. And organizations like Cancer Care can help you find clinical trials that are in your neck of the woods or very close by. The reason I say think about a clinical trial is because some of the new drugs that you're not going to be able to get unless you join a clinical trial are very active and show real promise. So the taking advantage of clinical trials is twofold. One is that you will get potentially a new active drug, and you will contribute to our knowledge and to contribute to the improvement in taking care of patients with ovarian cancer. So for me, it's a win-win. If you're not eligible for a clinical trial or you can't find a clinical trial that's convenient, then there are standards that are used in platinum sensitive. In platinum resistant, it's a little more challenging, although there was some data from last year's big cancer meetings that showed that the anti-angiogenesis agents, the bevacizumab-like drugs, could be very active in the platinum resistant setting. So I can't emphasize enough the important role of clinical trials. It really helps us advance where we are. When I first started doing this, being a GYN oncologist, our survival rate was nowhere near where it is today, and it's simply because of the advances that we've made in understanding the surgery, understanding the chemotherapy, and in understanding the disease. And that really comes out of clinical trials and research. So it's important that we continue to do really all we can to encourage research and to encourage enrollment in clinical trials. Some of the highlights from this year's ASCO meeting, and ASCO is the American Society of Clinical Oncology, which is a huge meeting held in Chicago. And I'll just very briefly go over some of the trials. There were trials looking at surgery, trials looking at chemotherapy, and trials looking at new agents. And just in the interest of time, I'll go over just the new agents. So I talked a little bit about the PAZO data, pazopanib, which is a oral multi-kinase inhibitor. And what they did was they gave it in the consolidation setting, where the consolidation is to give the treatment after you finish with the first line to consolidate that complete remission. And what they found was what we call a progression-free survival, the time that the patient is without cancer, to be 5 months longer than compared to placebo. So we clearly, with agents like PAZO and agents like Avastin or bevacizumab, have pushed the disease-free intervals out. And 5 months is considered clinically significant. There's also a new drug that I think is exciting, the folate receptor drugs. Ovarian cancer, we've learned from research and clinical trials, has folate receptors. And those folate receptors can be targeted with a drug called vintafolide. And there was one trial that looked at vintafolide and combination with Doxil versus Doxil alone. And Doxil is one of the drugs that we use as second or third line. The data was immature, but from other studies that have been published to date, that's a very exciting drug to think about for the future. And it's really a targeted therapy. And one of the studies that's done with it checks your tumor for folate receptors. It's a special study that's tagged to go to folate receptors. The patient is scanned, and if your tumor has folate receptors, this would be a very good clinical trial to enroll in. There was also some data on metformin. And this was interesting in diabetic patients. It was, again, a clinical trial, the MIMOSA clinical trial. And they looked at diabetics in that trial who were on metformin versus diabetics that weren't on metformin. Metformin is a drug that we use in the treatment of diabetes. The study had very small numbers, but there was a definite improvement in overall survival in the metformin group. So this, I think, is very exciting because this could be used potentially as a preventive agent, or this could be used to consolidate the responses. And again, consolidation is given after first line or second line or even third line therapy to prevent a recurrence. So there were some other drugs, polo-like kinase inhibitors. Velasertib was tested in a platinum-resistant population. And although they didn't report a benefit, they reported that they wanted to look at the biomarkers, again, looking at evidence of personalized or targeted therapy. So overall, I came away from the ASCO meeting very encouraged that there were many trials ongoing, that there were several new drugs in the pipeline, and the importance of clinical trials in advancing our knowledge. So in the next couple of minutes, I'll just talk a little bit about side effects and pain and how to communicate with your healthcare team, because I think these are really important issues. I tell my patients to tell me everything that's going on with them. Otherwise, I have no way of knowing, and I can't fix what I don't know is broken. My experience is most of my patients will tell me everything is fine, and then when I talk to my nurse or my nurse practitioner, she'll tell me that, you know, the patient is having discomfort with intercourse, or the patient is having troubles with delayed nausea, or the patient's not sleeping, or there's peripheral neuropathy. And we have means of affecting all of those symptoms. There is absolutely no reason that a patient should have any of these symptoms without trying a multitude of medical and non-medical therapies. So I strongly encourage everyone on the phone today that if you have any side effects, if you're having pain, if you're having nausea, if you're having discomfort with intercourse, if you're having hot flashes, talk to your nurse practitioners, talk to your doctors, talk to your nurses, because we have little tricks up our sleeves that we can really work as a team and be very effective in making the chemotherapy experience as pleasant as possible. So to finalize, communicating with your healthcare team is very important. Although you think your physicians and the nurses are really busy, we're never too busy to stop and listen. And, you know, we may not be able to take care of it that minute, but I try to return all my phone calls before I go home for the day so that we settle everybody down and we take care of our patients and we take care of them as a healthcare team. It's, in my opinion, no longer sustainable to be a solo practitioner. You really have to work as a team. So with that, I will stop, and I believe that Diana Bearden is going to talk to us about nutrition.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ronowitz, for really a tour de force, really covering ovarian cancer very substantively, and I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A, but that was really wonderful. Thank you. And our next speaker is Diana Bearden. And Diana is a nutritionist. She's a supervisor, clinical nutrition, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutritional concerns and eating hints. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. And my goal is to discuss tips for managing side effects that can impact your nutrition. The first thing to know is that eating well during your treatment can provide you the energy to do the things you enjoy, as well as maintaining your weight and preserving your muscle mass. Patients who maintain good nutrition tend to tolerate their treatment better and have a faster recovery and deal better with managing through side effects. Excessive weight loss can cause treatment delays. It can also cause breaks in your treatment and slow the healing process. By meeting nutritional goals during your treatment and maintaining your weight, preserving your lean muscle mass, those are all components in accomplishing a successful treatment process. Nausea, vomiting, a decrease in appetite, taste changes, mouth sores, diarrhea, constipation, and fatigue are common challenges experienced by patients that can pose as barriers to meeting your nutritional goals. And I'd like to go ahead and give a little bit of information on how you can address some of these issues if you're going through them in a helpful way, hopefully, to help maintain your nutritional to help to meet your nutritional goals. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is nausea and vomiting and a poor appetite. So ways to address these issues are by eliminating foods that a lot of times have offending odors. So hot foods or foods that are very fragrant can a lot of times initiate the experiencing nausea. So trying cold foods can be very helpful. They have less odors associated with them and tend to do better with patients who are suffering from that side effect. Focusing on bland foods can also be very helpful. A lot of times foods that have a lot of flavor They at the same time sometimes have some odors that go with them as well. So you may be doing well with that beforehand, and it may have never bothered you before, but a lot of times that can trigger nausea in patients. So focusing on things such as dry crackers, toast, avoiding foods that are overly sweetened, those that are fried or greasy, can also help improve your tolerance. And it, a lot of times with patients, it's just keeping something on your stomach. When you're going through treatment, not only is your schedule very congested because you're going from one appointment to the next and sometimes don't have time to run and get something to eat, but a lot of times also patients are taking medications, they don't feel well, and so are they're tired and fatigued, and so eating is a lot of times pushed to the side, and not having something on your stomach a lot of times with medications can also result in nausea. So ways to help with a poor appetite, focusing on small, frequent meals is very helpful. The overwhelming feeling of, oh, my goodness, I've got to eat so many different things, I have so much food I have to consume, can just turn a patient off. So breaking it down into small, frequent meals can be very helpful. These small meals can consist of high-calorie and high-protein foods to focus on the nutrients that you need. Eliminating stress at mealtimes can also be very helpful. If you're anxious or you're very nervous, that's going to affect your digestion. And so trying to relax and just give yourself a moment before starting meals, mealtime can be very helpful. Exercising as tolerated and allowed by your healthcare team may also be a helpful tool for patients. And exercising can not only help with digestion, which a lot of times is something patients are struggling with, but it can also help with, you know, relieving some stress and anxiety and redirecting your thoughts. That can be very helpful. Taste change is another issue that patients may be faced with during treatment. Some tips we can try with patients is our oral hygiene. Keeping very good oral hygiene is important. We can try some different rinses with like baking soda and water to help cleanse your palate. Taste changes also can mean that you're experiencing an identified taste such as a metallic-y flavor, or it may just be an off flavor in your mouth you can't seem to put your finger on, but things just start not tasting right and that flavor's in your mouth all the time. So trying something tart or using a peppermint to help re-cleanse your palate can be very helpful if you're going through something like that. A metallic taste, like I mentioned a minute ago, is very common with some chemotherapies, and simple changes like using plasticware or drinking from a glass container rather than a metal container can be very helpful, and avoiding foods that are packaged in cans themselves can also help eliminate that experience. If you're going through something more like just having a dull taste, you can try adding some tart flavors such as pickles and lemons or vinegar. Another tip we encourage patients to do are try foods that you didn't previously like, because interestingly enough, sometimes those will start to taste good again, and you know, it may be something that you can tolerate during this time. If you're experiencing mouth sores, we suggest choosing soft, moist foods that are easy to swallow and avoiding rough and textured and acidic foods. They can cause more irritation. Cut your foods into small bites so that you're not having to manipulate the food in your mouth too much. We may even have to change the texture of your food potentially just to help through rough times. And using supplement drinks as needed can also be an option. Always maintaining a good hydration is also very important. A lot of times when we're dehydrated, we don't always know it, but one of the early signs is just you're having a dry mouth. And so staying hydrated can be very helpful. A change in bowel function may also be an issue that that you experience, but it can switch back and forth either from constipation to diarrhea because we really – you know, the treatment, it depends on the type of treatment, but you can react one way or the other. And if you're going through constipation, we need to know the reason for the constipation. There's a lot of sources that you may be going, maybe experiencing or exposed to that can cause constipation. But some simple things we can consider in changing your diet can be to modify the fiber, increasing the fluid potentially. Pain medications and decreased activity can also result in constipation. So like I said, we really kind of need to look at the whole picture to give you the best advice to move forward. But talk with your healthcare team about this so that they can address it sooner than later. There's no reason to let things like this go for an extended period of time when they can be treated quite quickly. So if you're experiencing diarrhea, staying hydrated is essential, and so this also may require incorporating some different solutions to help you rehydrate not only the fluid but some of the electrolytes. We may even talk about adding some soluble fiber to your diet and as a possibility, but there again, it's about the reason for the diarrhea, the cause for it. And lastly, just to touch on fatigue, fatigue is multifactorial. There's a lot of reasons you can be experiencing fatigue, but one thing nutritionally we can encourage patients to do to work on tackling it is getting enough fluid in and meeting your nutritional needs. If you're struggling with this and you're having challenges, please talk with your healthcare team, arrange a time to meet with your dietitian so she can help provide you with some tips and some things you can try to see if that would be helpful. And again, the sooner the better. So I hope this has been helpful, and this concludes my thoughts, and I'm going to hand it back over to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Diana, for just a wonderful presentation and lots of helpful hints to everybody on the call. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Caroline Edlund. Caroline is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care, and Caroline is going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care, as well as the important role of support groups. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Caroline.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. I would like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups. And at this time, Cancer Care is offering an online support group specifically for ovarian cancer patients. So these groups offer a unique opportunity to talk with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we have learned from today's program, too, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of, and our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and for your family. A Cancer Care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are there to help you. So please contact us at 1-800-813-4673 or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak to you today.
Well, thank you so much, Caroline. That was wonderful. And actually, I know there'll be questions for you as well during the Q&A. And we now do have time for questions. Actually, I want to thank all of our speakers. And I'm going to ask, Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board and to tell you all how to ask questions. And we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get your question, just please call us at the end of the call at 1-800-813-4673. And I'll repeat that number at the end of the call again. So but let's see how many we can take now. Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Allison S. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. I just have a question. I have had the BRCA1, BRCA2 test done, and I didn't have any mutations, but should my daughter also have that test done?
Well, thank you for that question. Dr. Runowitz, could you address that question?
Sure. So I'm assuming that you have ovarian or breast cancer, and if that's true, then when you're testing negative, it may be that you do have a mutation, but we can't identify it given our current technology. So if what we call the index case, the person who has the cancer, that person gets tested and is negative, then there may be a mutation in the family, but we don't know it, and testing the children will not be helpful.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. And our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Arthur C. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you very much. My wife was diagnosed with metastatic brain mets from her ovarian cancer. And I understand brain metastasis from ovarian is exceedingly rare, but I was just wondering if the doctor could comment on whether she's seeing an increased amount of brain mets in her patients, and if so, what are the complications as a result of that?
Dr. Runowitz, could you address that?
Sure. You might recall when I was giving the background that I've said that lots has changed in ovarian cancer. And one of the things that we have changed is the natural history. So in the old days, we didn't see brain metastases. It was very uncommon. However, recently, because we've changed the natural history with more and more therapies, so we can have patients out 5, 6, 7, 8 years getting treatment, and we are beginning to see unusual manifestations that we didn't see in the past, like brain metastases. So the answer is yes, we're all seeing more of this, and I think it's because we are keeping our patients alive as a chronic disease, which is very different than what the textbooks show.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. And our next question.
Again, to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touchtone telephone.
And we do have a question, actually, from one of our online participants. So the question is, my grandmother and mother both have had breast cancer. As being a female in my mid-20s, what are some preventive measures I can take? Am I at high risk to develop ovarian cancer? How reliable is the BRCA test? Would you recommend a preventive mastectomy based on a positive BRCA score? Dr. Runowitz, could you address this? And I know this is a question that we're getting a lot.
Sure.
Time on this one.
So it sounds like the family has been identified with a known mutation, because that's very important. You can't assume that you are a BRCA mutation just because you have a strong family history. So if the mother and the grandmother have been tested, either one, and there is a BRCA mutation, then the person who's concerned in her 20s can get tested. The question then is, what do we do with that information? And we would try to think about the preventive aspects. And so this is very hard and sounds a little crass and like I'm not a caring physician, but one needs to think about what's the worst cancer given the two. You know, better you should never get a cancer. And having the BRCA mutation, by the way, doesn't mean you'll get cancer. but it's a red flag for being at very high risk. So if you had to get breast or ovarian cancer, you would probably choose to get breast cancer as opposed to ovarian cancer. So you'd want to aim your prevention more at ovarian cancer. And you may remember when I talked about risk factors and risk reduction that the birth control pill reduces your risk of ovarian cancer. There is some data that the birth control pill, when taken for an extended period of time, for more than 10 years, may increase your risk of breast cancer. So you might be trading off, but there have been small series that have shown that patients with BRCA mutations have safely taken the birth control pill. So for my patients with a known BRCA mutation who are in their 20s, I would talk to them about getting pregnant if they wanted to have babies or going on the birth control pill. And if they had the BRCA mutation starting at age somewhere between 25 to 35, we could think about doing things like a breast MRI or mammogram, again, depending on the specifics of the family history.
Well, thank you. It's very, very informative and helpful. We have another question from one of our online participants, actually, and that question is, is it true that a woman who has had her ovaries removed cannot get ovarian cancer?
So that's a good question, too, because if you think about what I talked about with the fallopian tube, it's very possible that if the tumor starts in the fallopian tube, it actually never involves the ovary. So we actually do see women who have had their ovaries removed with or without their fallopian tubes who develop peritoneal cancer. And peritoneal cancer is, if you think about your abdomen, your stomach area, as being a big saran wrap bag with the intestines and the uterus and the ovaries inside that saran wrap bag, primary peritoneal cancer is a cancer that is on that saran wrap bag, on that lining. And we think now that it's probably related to seeding from a fallopian tube cancer, not really an ovarian cancer. So the very long-winded answer to your question could have just said, yes, it's very possible, but I think understanding why is a little helpful.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. And another online question is, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer recently. Do I have fertility options, and who should I talk to about my fertility options? Dr. Runowitz?
So fertility in cancer patients is really something that is emerging as a very important issue because we are seeing cancers that are occurring in young women. So it will really depend on the stage that you think the disease is and where you are in getting treatment. So, for example, if you've had surgery and you've already had both ovaries, fallopian tubes, and uterus removed, then you're going to have to get a surrogate egg and a surrogate uterus. On the other hand, if you have a different kind of ovarian cancer, not the what we think of as ovarian cancer, which is the epithelial high-grade serous carcinoma, but let's say you have a germ cell, which is another kind of ovarian cancer, and you only have your ovary and fallopian tube removed, you still have your ovary and fallopian tube on the other side, and you have a uterus, so you will be able to get pregnant. It's unusual in ovarian cancer to know ahead of surgery that you have a cancer as far as saving an embryo or saving an egg, because it's usually not that easy to tell preoperatively to make those kinds of plans, as opposed to a young woman who may have breast cancer and will undergo chemotherapy, and she knows that she's at risk for early menopause, so she wants to either have an embryo harvested or an oocyte, one of her eggs, harvested.
Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Deanna A. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, Deanna. Your question.
Hi, how are you? My mom has primary peritoneal. She was diagnosed almost 3 years ago with stage 3C at the time of surgery. And we're 3 years in, and she's had no remission to this point. So outside of 2 weeks off, 3 weeks off in between her six cycles, it's been nonstop chemo. What we've found has been the best, which she's been on for quite some time now, is carboplatin and Avastin.
Mm-hmm.
We're just wondering at this point, where we feel like we're at the stage where maybe we need to look further past our oncologist or start going to maybe the bigger hospitals, that offer. We're just unsure at this point what maybe our next steps can be to, you know, see where we can go from here, since the chemo obviously is not working, you know, to the extent for remission. And she is platinum resistant. She was diagnosed platinum resistant. Is there any suggestions or contact or any information you can give on possibly where we can go from here?
Diana,
so
thank you for that question.
Sure. So you want to use resources like Cancer Care or cancer.gov for the clinical trials. And it's very hard. Hopefully your doctor or a nurse practitioner or somebody in the doctor's office and a navigator through, the American Cancer Society's program can help you go through the cancer.gov or any of the clinical trial sites. Because there's some very interesting new drugs. The folate receptor, for example, the ventifolide EC145, is a drug that is works totally different. It works on folate receptors, and there's actually a radiologic test that one does before. So that drug is available through clinical trials, and I'm actually in the process of getting it by compassionate release for one of my patients. Compassionate release means that the drug company, in this case it's Endocyte and Merck, will give it to you if you get your own IND, your investigational new drug. So the answer to your question about going to a major medical center is probably a good idea for at least knowing what the options are, and then some of this can be done at home, even though she's being taken care of at a major center. And certainly I would look on to the clinical trial site on cancer.gov and see if there's any trials in platinum resistant that she would be eligible for. And then there are some maintenance trials, if you can get her back into a remission, that will hopefully maintain or consolidate that remission.
Excellent. And Dana, we'll call you after the call as well. Caroline, do you want to just comment upon just the importance of getting support when you're trying to actually access all the care in the world for someone you care the most about?
Absolutely. There are clearly so many questions and issues to try to work through and navigate, and support groups can be a wonderful way to connect with others who understand and relate to some of your experience. And we offer groups for patients and for loved ones as well. I think there can be a lot of comfort and empowerment in joining a community of other people who relate to what you're going through. So we do offer support groups face-to-face to residents of New York City, and then also over the telephone and online for clients that are reaching us from farther away. And you're always welcome to call our Hope line to learn more about that and to register.
Excellent. And Dr. Ronowitz, could you say a word about the comprehensive cancer centers, the national centers of the
sure.
National designated centers?
Sure.
I think that
sure.
might be helpful to Deanna as well.
Sure. So there's the National Cancer Institute has designated, I think, about 60-some cancer centers in the country as giving comprehensive care to patients. They have the latest in clinical trials. But if that's not within your reach, and again, you can just go onto the web and look up NCI designated cancer centers, and you find them pretty much across the United States, but obviously clustered in certain areas like the Northeast. But there's also good cancer centers at every medical school. And there are many more medical schools than there are NCI-designated cancer centers. And the medical schools tend to attract the best and the brightest. So there are 144 medical schools in the country, and they're pretty distributed throughout. I mean, not pretty. They are distributed throughout the United States. Some states have more than others, but every state has at least one. I think maybe Delaware doesn't because it shares with Jefferson, which apparently is not that far across the river. So access to the medical school academic health centers may be another option in addition to the NCI designated cancer centers.
Excellent. Well, this has been an extraordinary call, and I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been just an amazing amount of information for people to take in and provided with a great deal of compassion and information. And I want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions either on the phone or online. I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning a program like this, we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so I do want to remind all of you to really take advantage of all the services that Caroline so eloquently reviewed in terms of the services that you can access from Cancer Care. We have a staff of many oncology social workers, and we're here to provide hope and support to you, both talking with you by counseling or support groups on the phone and online. And we also, of course, have these workshops, and we have materials that we can send to you as well, both publications and fact sheets. And, of course, we're always accessible just to call and with a question or concern you might have. And you don't have to wait until you feel it's really urgent. You can call at any time. Our services are free. You can call us at 1-800-813. And for our international visitors or those of you who prefer the web, you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with ovarian cancer or with cancer in general. I want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and we're here to help you. And please do take advantage of both Cancer Care Services and all the other organizations that we've sent you information about as well. Thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.